Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Sangoma, Stories from the Frontlines of Mediation. I'm your host, Batabile Mtombeni, mediator and negotiation coach. My guest today is Ken Newman. We're going to talk about the history of family mediation, and we're going to find out who he wanted to be when he was a little boy. You're listening to a piece called Rope Dojo. It is by Michelle Webb, and it is from her CD, DC Istanbul. Sit back and enjoy. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to tell you a story. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Sangoma, Stories from the Frontlines of Mediation. I am so happy that you have decided to join us this evening, and I'm also really pleased to welcome my guest for this evening, Ken Newman, to the show. Hi, Ken.
Hi, and thanks for having me again on your show.
Well, I'm very glad that you agreed to come on, and actually I'm saying welcome back. You were on a show that I aired last year.
Yes.
We had a good time doing that, so
we did.
I look forward to another good time with this show as well. So one of the things we want to do with Sangoma is to talk from the heart and get to the heart of what makes mediators do what they do and what mediation is all about. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. But first, I want to let folks know, if you're listening and want to continue to listen and want to get reminders about the show, be sure to follow the show. If you're online, there's a button for you to press there, and it says follow. So I encourage you to go ahead and do that. Also understand that the show is available for download. So it's available through iTunes, and there's a little icon there on the page as well that you can click on to be able to get their download and time that thing. I'm stumbling a little bit because I've just gotten a message here on my browser that maybe issues of the show. I think because we've had such a thunderstorm and so there have been interference. So I'm sorry about that. If you are having trouble hearing the show, we're going for beer, and if we can, we are ready to start our conversation. Ken, I am really curious about your background. I'm always curious about what inspires a mediator to choose mediation, stay in mediation. Tell me about, are you a native New Yorker?
Yes, I grew up in the Bronx.
In the Bronx. And at that time when you were growing up in the Bronx, what was it like?
Well, it the only thing I knew, it was a very nice, it was very comfortable, very much of a neighborhood, just like it is here in some ways on the Upper West Side, but somewhat smaller. And you felt very at home, and each part in the, each neighborhood has it, had its own candy store, had its own grocery store. There were different streets, and you really kept in your neighborhood very much.
There wasn't really a reason for you to have to go out to some other neighborhood for things
no,
you needed.
No, you didn't go out to another neighborhood, and sometimes that might have been risky even for some people's point of view. You stayed in a narrow band, people's elementary schools, though we always called them public schools because they had numbers like PS90. That's the school that I went to. And you walked to school, and you walked to your junior high school, which now became middle schools, and you stayed in your neighborhood generally. That was, everyone had their own little neighborhood. And people four or five blocks away who went to a different elementary school, you wouldn't know these people because you might have met them in junior high school, or in many cases, not until high school.
So a stranger walking through your neighborhood would really stand out.
I would think so, like a small town.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of it, but very much like a small town.
Well, you mentioned that it might be a little bit, you know, risky to walk through a different neighborhood.
Well, I was somewhat joking, but, you know, there were always, like, when I was in junior high school, there were always these rumors that the Fordham Baldies were coming. The Fordham Baldies, which was a real group or gang, there were gangs in the Bronx at the time, and there were, and they would invade neighborhoods, and people were afraid. I never saw them, but there was often talk, oh, the Fordham Baldies are coming today. Someone would start a rumor.
It's amazing the power not only of rumor, but I guess imagination is, you know, fantastic bogeyman.
We pictured it happening. We ran home that day, to be coming. That is true.
They came.
They didn't come to our, they must have come other places those days because I didn't see them.
Yeah. You know, as mediators, we deal with conflicts a lot. And I'm curious about early experiences of conflict or understandings of conflict. What was that like for you growing up?
Well, it depends on the country you grow up in. And home didn't have a conflict. In fact, in my family, conflict. People sometimes, you know, I put in an apartment building, actually. I heard people yelling in the windows. There was no air conditioning sign. You could hear fighting times. You know, people have paid attention to it, but it was something that I relate to strongly because there was that kind of fighting in my mom. Of course, there was, you know, all that. Nothing like before. Nothing like times. You did hear people. There were people, you know, that you did hear fighting, screaming, shouting a great deal of. So you're exposed to that. You see people in the street. If you ride the subways, you see things. And so, of course, you grow up seeing that. You know, in schools, you know, you saw kids getting into fights, particularly in junior high school, not in elementary school. No, so you're aware of conflict all the time. Plus, you know, you watch television you know, you see the news. So you become aware of conflict in the world. My father had been a soldier in World War II. A cousin of mine was in the Korean War. So you know about these things. You grow up, conflict and the resolution of conflict is part of everyone's life and something we're all exposed to from a very early age.
But it sounds like it wasn't something that you yourself were involved in to a great
extent. That's right. I wasn't. In fact, there was only one occasion I remember coming home from junior high school with two other kids, kind of like there was a thing when you were holding your books under your arm, you loosely, someone would go behind you and flip them out. And then there was one fight I got into with a neighbor in the backyard of our building when I was in the sixth grade. Kid punched me in the face.
Ow.
That was the only time I was really assaulted like that. It was Jeffrey Romoff, if he happens to be listening. And
you remember his name?
Well, I knew him. Yeah, I remember his name. He was in the next building. You know, you knew all the kids in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, you knew all the kids down, you know, within a two-block radius. Not much beyond that, but there were a lot of kids then. And, that was Jeffrey. And that tooth later had to be removed. because it was accessed when I was in college. Yeah, so so please listen. Let's go work this out. But that was the only time I was assaulted as a kid. My friend Babakov, who I don't know if he's listening, I sent him the link. But he was a few blocks east in the neighborhood. There was more going on, and he was not regularly going home to school. If I recall, if he calls in later, if we have that opportunity, he can share that with. So it was there, but my own life did not include it. I was never in fights other than one time, Jeffrey.
I want to let folks know about calling in. Thank you for reminding me about the number to call in is 8532979. That's 818-532-99. And if you want to be heard on the air, press number 1 and put you on the air. So I was actually wondering when you told me about Jeffrey. It sounds as though you never told anybody, or at least an adult.
No, I'm sure I told my mother about it. Of course, yeah, I don't remember. This is a long time ago, of course. No, I'm sure I told. You know,
but it doesn't seem like anything happened to Jeffrey, and she didn't follow up on it.
You know, I don't recall. I mean, I wasn't. It didn't look. I wasn't bleeding. It wasn't. Didn't need any medical attention. It was many years later that tooth cut was loose. You know, but. No. She didn't go to Jeffrey's mother and say, "Well, your son." No. We'd work those things out ourselves, I guess. And I didn't realize how serious it was. And I was thrown a little bit, and that was it. And, you know, no, it didn't call for any intervention.
Do you know why he hit you?
No, you'd have to ask him. But, you know, I guess we were playing stickball in the backyard, and something happened, and, you know, mm-hmm. it didn't lead to anything, you know, after that.
Right. I mean, I'm digging because it's an interesting moment to examine what happened.
It wasn't all that traumatic, and I don't think of it very often, certainly, but since you asked, that was my association, but it's not something that was traumatic really at all. But I think what's singular about it is that it's of all the incidents, that's the worst thing that ever happened to me. I've never been mugged. I walk down the street late at night. I've always been very careful. You learn how to walk down the street. I've never been approached. I had a few people shadowing me at times, and I knew how to walk back to another corner. Nothing. I've never been mugged. No one's ever done anything like that. And
knocking on wood as we speak, right?
Yeah, knocking on wood. But no, so I've never had any. You know, no one in the car ever cut me off and got out or anything like that. And nothing ever happened on the subway. And I guess I've been fortunate, but I think actually being careful. And I actually met a patient of mine, a guy who had some issues around anger. He was aware of him, going on it. He said, "Never get on the subway angry." And what he meant, and you know, you say, "Well, what does that mean?" He meant, he had many other issues. If you were an angry guy and you got on the subway, some other angry guy is going to find you. That's his experience.
Anger was going to find you.
If you're angry, well, you're trapped, maybe. But you're angry, and you're sitting there angry. Someone who was trapped, someone else who's angry, was his point of view. Not that. That was, and we took that. And actually, I think that's probably the right on the subway angry.
And it's fascinating, the point that he made. You mentioned that this person was a patient of yours, so it's sort of shadowing what you eventually end up doing. But I am curious about what you thought you were going to be when you were a young man growing up. You know, you ended up working in an area that deals a lot with conflict, when in your own life it wasn't something that was so,
well, it was
so present.
It was a particular kind, you know, the kind of work I do is mostly conflict of people, you know, in marriages getting divorced. And actually that came about in a couple of ways. One, as a therapist, I was working with a couple. This goes back actually to the 1976. And the couple, as part of the work, wound up deciding to get divorced. Now, actually, it should be known that therapists don't see that as necessarily a failure of the work. Sometimes it's seen by everyone, including the couple at the time, as this was a good thing to do. You know, you can always look back on it, but it's not automatically thought of as a failure. And in fact, I really like this couple. They were a bit young, a few years younger than myself. And I said to them, instead of them going off to lawyers, this is before I even knew about divorce mediation, actually. Instead of going off to lawyers, which is what people often did, mostly did, only did at that time, I said, why don't you come up to my house for the day and let's talk about how you're going to do this. Let's talk about the settlement of this. And they did come up for the day. We actually needed a second day. I felt I needed a long time to do this. I hadn't read about mediation. It is 1976. People are undoubtedly starting to do this already. You know, people have been doing it, I'm sure, for a while. And they come up to the house, and we actually work out a very interesting parenting arrangement. They had they were living in Rockland County, and they worked in an arrangement where the mom stayed out and dad moved elsewhere. One night a week, he stayed over in the house so she didn't have to come home and she could hang out with friends in the city. But that a whole parenting arrangement. We worked out some of the fines. And then, not having resources or working with people who drafted agreements, found an attorney who drafted it. And I had much contact with his family for many years, actually. And things, went up and down. But basically lived with that for a very long time. We were very young. I went to the house, met the children, and they were in contact with them as themselves. So that was my first real divorce mediation, but I didn't see it as divorce mediation.
How did you come up with it? The first time you done it?
I just thought it would take several hours. And it was upstairs at the time. I was actually living in Woodstock at the time. And so logistically it made sense. It was also done in a more comfortable situation I had a home office at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it just worked out. And then it wasn't for several years. And I did a few things like that and never thought of it. And then found out about divorce mediation. And then realized that other people were doing this, therapists were doing it mostly, and matrimonial attorneys, and I think a lot of people started out just by doing it. It should be noted, and we talk about this in our basic training, how divorce mediation in a more formal way started. It was started by an attorney, not a matrimonial attorney, who himself went through a very bad divorce. His name was Kugler. And he went through a divorce, and he says there has to be a better way. And he dedicated to his former wife and their attorneys, and he talks about how it became a very embittered process, and they showed me there had to be a better way. And so he then starts the field of what's called structured divorce mediation. That's the title of the book.
And around what time was that?
In 1976, and then he trained a number of people, caught on in a sense. I mean, it was like a household word. It caught on, and we started talking about professionals, mostly, as I said, matrimonial attorneys and family therapists, or the field of magic, since then, many of the people who were disciplines have been drafted. And then we started, I started the we called them the Center for Family and Divorce Mediation, Howard Yam and Eleanor Yam, in 1982 in Rockland County.
Mm-hmm.
And then we expanded to New York City. We knew we were doing something new, actually, and we felt we had to try it out in Rockland County first, before we opened in New York, in a sense. and we thought of it that way. That was 30 years ago, essentially. We really thought of it that way, and it's true, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we brought in other people, Steve Abel, certainly, who among them. And
certainly.
And we started a center. And we had decided then that we were going to do this really as a center rather than as individuals doing it. And mm-hmm. It's been extremely fulfilling, and many of us start to think of ourselves as mediators.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, even though we might be something else as well, mm-hmm. when someone says, "What do?" You know, you have to have, usually it's a single word answer.
Yeah, right.
You
right.
know, and what do you do? I'm a
right. Right.
And so I think the field has worked very hard to create its own identity, because there was no "I'm a mediator."
Mm-hmm.
You know, the exception to that, of course, is labor mediators, because labor mediation has been around since
much longer.
Well, since, you know, the early 1900s, when the federal government creates mm-hmm. a service for this to deal with labor strikes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been around a long time. And there's an obvious similarity in that after a labor strike is over, the people are going to have to deal with each other still, as opposed to disputes that lawyers often deal with. When you sue someone, you're not going to ever see them again.
So there's no ongoing relationship.
There's no ongoing relationship. Yeah.
Well, this is where we ended up. But I promised folks we were going to talk a little bit about what you wanted to be when you were growing up. So who did you want to be when you were growing up?
Well, I want to be myself. But
it's interesting because I wrote it if you want to be. I was in terror.
You were away. What did you say that?
Who did you want to be when he was a little boy? Yeah.
Yeah. When I was a little boy, I didn't really think about it much. And I mean, the choices for someone growing up at the time in a Jewish family in Bronx was somewhat limited. You know, I wasn't going to be a baseball player, you know. And,
so what is it, lawyer, banker,
yeah,
doctor?
The choices are somewhat limited. However, I think we asked the question else, actually, which is, growing up, I often said, I didn't really know why she brought it up. She now makes sense. She said, "Would you rather be a big fish in a little pond or a little fish in a big pond?" Now, I think that expression, while still in usage perhaps, is not as much in usage now as it was then. I think that was more – that's my sense. I'm not certain about that. And, you know, she asked that question, and I think I pondered it. I think I thought about that, actually. It turns out I became a big fish in a little pond. I could have – had I become a lawyer or a doctor – I would have undoubtedly been a little fish in a much bigger pond, certainly,
right.
You know. But there is the choice isn't would you rather be a big fish, you know. The choice is, those are the choices you think about. And I think you orient yourself in one way or another. If you want to be an investment banker, you're going to be a little fish in a big pond.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be a divorce mediator, you're going to be in a little pond for sure. You know?
Sure.
And,
so then you said it's not something that you didn't really think about when you were very young. When did you start to think about, what do I want to do with my life?
I think you start thinking about it. You start thinking about it before you get to junior high school. I mean, people start thinking about it because there is some pressure, and I went to, you know, good classes and then good high school and all this. And I think people start taking it very seriously. You know that you're going to be a professional. But some of my earlier thoughts, actually, which are kind of interesting, and I thought about it now for the first time in a long time.
Awesome.
Because I knew that I saw on my screen that that's what you were going to ask me, because we didn't really prepare this show at all. Last show,
the best way to do it.
Last show, we kind of had a topic and we talked about,
sure,
you know, real things. And so I didn't, you know, we didn't prepare this show. What I thought about, at one point, I actually thought I wanted to be an accountant.
Interesting.
And, I was interested in math and numbers and finances and that kind of thing. I thought to be an accountant. And the people who I knew, who I admired, who did well in the system, well, you know. And I thought of that. I took a year of accounting in college. Something I recommend everyone do, actually. The other thing, I was very involved when I went to Hebrew school. I thought of becoming a rabbi.
Really?
Yeah. I was very drawn to that and very interested in that and sort of becoming a rabbi. And in a way, you just – and then later I started to become a –
You know, I'm thinking that. Because I was thinking, what was it that you drew you to that study of the text and the law and so, wait, you're a therapist. What do rabbis do?
Well, you know, that's right. And actually, if you're a mediator, you're a rabbi and an accountant all together. In a funny way, I realize that now we were deceiving.
That's fabulous.
Yeah, really is. Thank you. Thank you. No, it's really interesting because if a mediator isn't a rabbi and an accountant, what who are they?
Well, know? There you go.
and a therapist as well.
Right, right.
So it winds up really bringing in all of those possibilities.
You have fulfilled your purpose.
Well, I guess so, and I actually feel that of all the things I do professionally, and I do a number of different things, mm-hmm. I feel most comfortable being a mediator, mm-hmm. being a family mediator.
Well, you talked about starting out, you know, as a therapist working with this couple. You got this bright idea to bring them to your home, work through. Had you spoken with people before about how are you going to negotiate your divorce?
Had I spoken? Well, you know, as a therapist, when you work as a therapist with individuals, you realize, of course, that some of the people you're working with are going to get divorced. That's mm-hmm. part of the work. In fact, many people coming into mediation, many people blame their spouse's therapist for the fact they're getting divorced. And blame is the word that I'm using. But I think it's true that in the process of individual therapy, some people are able to face that they're really not happy in their marriages, and as a result of that, get strengthened and empowered to leave what they come to see as a bad situation. And I think that's the most common thing that happens. I think that said, I think there is some abuse by therapists of their role, their over-identification of and any number of things that get some therapists who work with individuals to promote divorce when that really shouldn't be happening necessarily in that way or at all. There are therapists who used to refer their patients to their own divorce lawyers, for example. Not uncommon even today.
Wow.
Yeah, I know you hear that, but it's true. And so I think that, well, mostly therapists help people in this regard. I know of so many situations where I would not say that was the outcome. And, you know, when Howard Yum and myself started talking, and you know, we started the center, we understood people go through when they are contemplating divorce, the whole divorce adjustment is for adults. We do it as therapists, and so when we started doing mediation, it was with that in mind, that sensitivity as to what people are going through, and really not to get, and Howard particularly developed the whole notion of the regression that takes place, something we all, you know, talk about, and I think, and understand what the regression is all about, that people go through.
And he's saying regression referring to behavior. Perhaps undermining and
yeah.
Juvenile?
Is that
harsh?
It may be gentle, yeah. Like juvenile at best. But I think that the adversarial divorce process encourages that and brings that out. And most typically, beyond a doubt, the mediation process, on the contrary, really plays to people's healthier sides, doesn't, you know, empowers them to not regress. And I think that's a big thing that mediators are offering people that the adversarial system is unlikely to. In fact, quite the contrary. There are practitioners who make it worse, either because they don't know anything else, because they think that's the right thing, or clearly in cases it's self-serving. I don't think anyone doubts that possibility. I'm not saying something that people haven't thought of or heard before. But certainly mediation process does not do that, quite the contrary.
Yeah.
And we realized early on, and the tremendous satisfaction that comes from really helping a couple, for us, and with that first couple I worked with, the satisfaction that comes from helping people not spin out, to be more adult-like, and really, in this case particularly, to do well by their kids.
Oh, yeah.
And mediation has always seen that as very much a central part of what we do. You know, obviously there are couples who get divorced, they don't have children. But I think the early focus was working with couples who had children. And a lot of people who are attracted to mediation are attracted on that basis. So more increasingly, I work with young couples in particular who haven't had children. And also know that mediation makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
And because people stay, more people actually, it's conversation friendly, quote unquote, divorce. When I was a kid, I remember my, you know, I knew very few people who were divorced, certainly. I mean, it was like, you know.
It was third, and like,
yeah,
it was
a bad thing to do. But I had one aunt who divorced, but I remember a friend of my father, a couple got divorced, and they came alone. They were friends, you know. And I remember when the woman came to the house, I was like embarrassed. I didn't see her. There was all this. Well, it was like embarrassed to see a divorced woman in my house somehow.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah, later on when
I... Well, I mean, you know what? It's not that interesting. Because I remember, you know, the change from there being a stigma to at least sort of almost a norm. I mean,
it's not... Stigma is nowhere there,
right,
in many circles. But I've been always in seeing this woman. Mm-hmm. And later on in thinking about this, obviously, I assume there was something sexual about it in some way, that there was something about her as a divorced woman. I was like 10 years old, 11 years old, and I had no other conclusion I could come to. But then a good friend of my father's, that guy he was friends with from World War II, and who were very close friends for the rest of their lives, he was divorced from his wife. That was the first divorce of someone who I really knew well, and who had children. And he would go see his children every Sunday, and they were. And I don't know if he saw them during the week, because my father would take my sister and myself and see Jack and his two sons, and he saw them Sunday, and that was. And this is the 1950s, and that's what people did when parents got divorced. The father saw the children on Sunday. Maybe he had dinner with them Wednesday night. I don't know for sure. Probably not, is my guess. This guy was a fine guy. I mean, he was nothing, you know, and he probably took them away for a week's vacation in the summer. And no one thought anything unusual about that kind of arrangement. That was what was normalized for divorce through the 1950s. Things started changing, of course, in the 1960s.
I do want to talk a bit about how things have developed in terms of parenting and also divorce itself. But I'm interested in backing up a little bit. And you know, I've taken your course of training, both the in-class and then the practicum. And what we are taught is a pretty well-thought-out process. You know, it has a beginning, it has an end, it flows and so forth. I understand, though, is when you were starting out, that wasn't necessarily there. You didn't have a handbook. You were in many ways making it wrong or referring to your sequence to do it. How did you
John Hanks in your book actually had, we didn't have it right away, right? There was the early books, Kugler has an early book. We use Kugler's book. And then when Glenn came out with his book, and there wasn't a lot of materials. It's back in 1982, there wasn't a lot of materials. Yeah, we didn't make it up as we go along. Exactly, we sat down for hours planning curriculum, and the Academy of Family Mediators actually arrived as the Academy of Professional Family Mediators, APFMnet.org. Which is a new organization, which is kind of a mediation to the front.
Awesome.
There was a group, and they had requirements of what a training program had to do. A lot of this, you know, took a lot of hours for people to sit down and figure out what do you need to teach people to do this work.
And what should be in the process.
Should be in the process. And there is a whole literature on this, and it's gotten – you know, modified and enhanced over these many years, you know, and now there are master's programs and, you know, so we've come a long way in a relatively short time.
Right. What did the lawyers say?
Well, I think what did the lawyers say? You know, I think lawyers fell into two main categories from early on. I mean, it's also changed in the last 30 years. There were lawyers who right away were part of this, and came on board extremely right away, you know, and saw, wow, this is what we should be doing as lawyers and as people and as people who want to help people. And then there were lawyers who said that this was a bad process. It was, you know, short of evil. There was a lot of talk at the time always of, is this the unauthorized practice of law? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's still some talk about it, but I think it's gotten to a very different place. And so there was a lot of talk about this for a long time. And I think lawyers are still in two camps. But really, I've done a lot of work in this field with lawyers. And, you know, lawyers really, you know, accept the process, a part of the process, you know, and I see lawyers as an integral part. There are still some lawyers who speak badly of mediation, and there's still a lot going on. By no means has this been settled. But certainly, if you look at the last 30 years, and I've been doing this, you know, for almost 30 years, and it's changed a lot, and without that.
Well, I am curious about some of the concerns that a lawyer might have. For example, there might be a concern that one party or the other is weaker, gives up more than they should have. They don't know what their rights are.
Of course, this is an early concern that mediators deal with. The first thing we always talk about in mediation is assessing the appropriateness of this couple to mediate, and for many reasons, a couple may not be important. We had to and the phrase that was used early on, actually, which is used a bit less today, but early on we always said that the mediator's job included leveling the playing field. And we still use that concept. I don't know if we use that term so much, but by empowering someone, by insisting that someone meet with an attorney from the very beginning, I actually find people meeting with financial planners to be extremely empowering and as well. And sometimes you make referrals to therapists. I think that a good mediator who understands all this will be always looking to level the playing field and be making appropriate referrals to other people. And that, in fact, both parties have to understand that. And if one party is trying to pull a fast one, you know, a mediator isn't going to go along with that. And you may lose cases along the way. By now, as I become more experienced, that's not likely to happen. You know how to do it. You know, you develop the techniques to do it. But certainly there are going to be people who think they can pull a fast one, much less so as the image and the knowledge and the reputation of mediators has become so much greater, so much more highly regarded. But it couldn't be highly regarded in the first year we're doing this. You know, it couldn't be while we're doing this as well, too, in my second case. You know, when you have been doing a while, from having had some experience, yeah. And it starts to make sense. You know, But certainly we've learned a lot, and it's actually we've learned a lot, and we know things now, and we develop techniques. And,
actually, I'm curious about that. You know, have done 30 worst of cases, but a couple walks in and talk to them, and it's the first few minutes. Can you tell how things are going to go?
Can you tell how things are going to go? You know, probably. I mean, I'm not sure what I do with that information. You mean, can you tell if it's going to be easy or hard, or is it going to – most cases, you know, well over 95% of the cases complete very relatively quickly and, you know, successfully. But, I know if it's going to be a hard case. If I do, I really tell people – you know, I stop telling people that it's going to take between, you know, 6 and 15 hours – you know, I don't really tell that to people anymore. People used to ask that, and of course, then if it takes 25, you told us it would take, you know. So I think you shouldn't really do that. Many cases will finish during that period of time, but there's a percentage of cases that are, you know, high conflict cases, and they just can't be done quickly. Mm-hmm. They're going to take longer. I often now use the help of attorneys and the good network of attorneys I've worked with, and even when new ones come in to the case, they understand to work this way, and I use that process, and it works well. And Can you tell? I hadn't really thought about that, but I suppose you can.
I mean, I'm asking the question in part because I remember something that you said during the practicum that I took about divorce and, you know, when we're talking about straight couples, if a woman files, you know, the divorce is likely to stick. If a man files, there might be a chance. Do you remember that?
Oh, who initiates? You mean who initiates in a sense?
Right, right. When is the marriage really over?
Well, you know, yes, I remember that now. It's a good question because, you know, I've been in the field for a long time and I worked at first at a clinic where I was doing intakes and a lot of the people who came in were getting divorced and there were couples who came in because they were getting divorced as well. And I remember, and I don't, there are statistics on this because you can look to see who's filed for divorce, though it's not 100% sure that it came to the idea of divorce really was. But by the way, what I've seen like trends and changes and having been in the field now for a long time, in the 1970s, divorce was initiated by men. By and large, it certainly felt to me as if 85% of the divorces were initiated by men. There are many reasons one can cite for this, but that may well be a fact. Even if women initiated it, technically, the man really initiated it. Now, in my practice, I've spoken to people about it, it absolutely seems that 80, 85% of the cases are initiated by women. Now, divorces are initiated by women. And I think that's an amazing statistic and an amazing fact as to how women have been so empowered in the last 40 years, at least on the Upper West Side. So I can't, it's really hard to generalize it. You know, we tend, I think, unfortunately, to take a view of our world from a somewhat limited point of view. And I don't know what it's like. I know what it's like in Westchester, you know, as well.
Right, 30 miles from here.
Yeah, on the Upper West Side, at least from, you know, in that part of Westchester. But you know, and speaking to colleagues, even in other parts of the country, mm-hmm. you have similar results. But I think that that's an amazing notion and one we have to take seriously mm-hmm. in understanding the divorce process. A number of years ago, I kind of came up with the term that men were running scared. Was my term for this.
In what way?
That women were now all of a sudden initiating divorces where the men were coming in and saying, no, can't we work this out?
Interesting.
And for the longest time, it was the men initiating divorces with the women coming in and saying, can't we work this out? An amazing shift in I've written about this and I have spoken about it except something like this, but I think I think it's an unbelievable shift in the culture, and there were many good reasons that this has happened. Yeah, in fact,
you know, I'm curious about that. One of the things that I thought about and has been said by people is that a lot of it is explained by women's economic empowerment. That you can graduate from college, kind of work, and be able to support yourself. Terror factor, get divorced, being left utterly destitute, no longer really holds.
Yes, of course. The economic opportunity for women, has really been a big factor.
Yes, but this is the second part of that. So then I wonder whether that allows to manifest what was always going on, except that, women couldn't get out of the marriage because of the financial factor. If the economics had changed, if culture had changed so that women had more access to their own income, earlier, would we have seen this shift in the numbers earlier as well?
There's no question we would have.
Marriage is different for women than for men in heterosexual couples, right?
That's right. And I think you always notice the answer to that very easily is, you know, Hollywood stars were always getting divorced. Hollywood, they were worried about, gee, could we afford two rents, you know? So I think that's certainly true. People say that introduction of equitable distribution as a phenomenon allowed women to now share in their husband's business and pension, where up until that time there was no equitable distribution, and in exchange, in a sense, women got permanent alimony. but got no value paid out for the husband's pension. So the whole concept, we changed the whole concept we talked about. Marital partnership was a big shift. And I think a lot of this really gets credited and go back to the women's movement starting in the 1970s. I think that's where we see the change in the culture. And then the men's movement, kind of, you know, a much smaller movement. Say, really, men's movement, really the women's movement, that, you know, in a sense. Oh. And
when you say men's movement, what do you mean?
Well, the same way women started going to see our group, conscious race groups, men started the same. And we had something called the men's movement, that it wound up taking the point of view of men wanting to have more time with their children and more rights as a parent and becoming more involved as parents. So that was very positive. But I think that was promoted by women first, and then men picked it up.
Well, it's interesting. It's a wonderful segue into talking about the present and how things tend to be arranged and what family mediation has inspired in terms of changing how divorced parents parent their children. You talked about your friend, your father's friend, who saw his children on Sundays. Mm-hmm. Things can be quite different now. What have you seen as a shift over the years?
Well, I think the shift has been men becoming much more involved, you know, as parents. Everyone sees that as a positive shift, I think. And men wanting, and you see, again, on the Upper West Side and perhaps other places where parents have 50-50 schedules, there's a kind of backlash, if you will, from that, that I think that some men come in asking for 50-50, sometimes in a disingenuous way, in order to pay less child support, or what they mentioned, less child support, some matter of principle. I think as many good things sometimes get split for some people. By and large, I think everyone agrees that fathers being more involved with their children in a way we see overall everywhere is a positive thing. And then you run into the problem that moms who don't want that. We don't want to not be with their children more of the time.
How does it play a role? I hear from men on a regular basis who say the courts are stacked against us, they don't care. Everything is for the woman, it's for the mother. In a situation where you have mom saying, you know, I don't really want to share time with children, perhaps she's angry, whatever the case might be, are the courts playing a role in balancing that?
Well, you know, it depends on the jurisdiction very much, obviously. Depends on the judge, depends on the people. You know, I think there is a bias. There's a presumption, there's a maternal preference bias in many courts, and many practitioners have this. Yeah, I mean, I think this is an evolving issue, and it's not until we really have real equality with men and women in the workplace that we're going to have it in other places also. And, you know, of course, we're not having that quite yet in most places. But I think probably, I mean, if you ask most practitioners, I think there is, and, you know, I always ask this question in the training. I think even among enlightened people, I think there is it's very hard to get away from some maternal preference bias in all of us, you know, unless we were raised just by two men. I mean, you know, I think that's going to be, you know, it's going to take a long time for that to change. And you know, it's changed, and you see it's changed. Certainly a way to go on that.
Sure, yeah. Sure. I'm interested as well in the development of the profession. And you talked about reviving the Academy of Called Professional Family Mediators, and there was a conference a couple weeks ago. What's going on with that?
Well, actually, yes. I'm very involved.
Sure.
We have a conference coming up at the end of September. But I think that family mediators are now, and we're calling them professional family mediators, people who make it their profession in this sense. We're thinking of this as their profession. They may do other things as well. Really want to see this go somewhere, and really needed to form this organization for many complex reasons. The story's on our website, but I think it's important for the field to really have a strong national organization that's going to promote family mediation in any number of ways, and we're ready for that to happen, and it's a very exciting time. And if people have any questions about it, they can go to the website, or they can call me as well. But, you know, I'll give the contact information.
Sure. What's the URL for the website?
It's www.apfmnet.org, Academy of Professional Family Mediators Net.org.
Okay, that's fantastic. So if people are listening and they're interested in using a mediator in their own family situations, what kinds of situations can a family mediator be involved in and help with?
That we just wrote something last night about that, so that's very good. You just asked the question in my mind, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's interesting because years ago, the Academy of Family Mediators, the organization, expanded the notion of family mediation to include small family businesses, certainly small businesses, synagogues and churches, schools, that there are a lot of small organizations that operate very similarly to the way families operate. Certainly a partnership operates very much like a family in many ways. And so the skills that we develop in working with couples are extended to that. Also, elder mediation issues, elder care and elder mediation issues has been clearly very popular as the population ages and doesn't age. So you know, people now would come in. We have disputes between siblings as the parent placement, there's financial issues, there's mediation of issues with facilities. So there's a whole area and specialty of elder mediation issues, and we see that as family issue also. We also see estate disputes as something that doesn't have to be litigated. I work with families dealing with estate disputes. You know, estate disputes can be pretty nasty. It's not uncommon that you hear of estate disputes.
Of course, yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, it's an opportune time. You know, folks are upset about losing their loved one. Perhaps there are surprises in the will. Perhaps there are things that both people don't want to let go of.
Yeah, and in fact, and even more so, I've seen many cases, and you get the people to talk about this, is that the parent who died wanted to still control from the grave. We even have that expression that there are people who wish to do that. As you might imagine that be, there are people who control from the grave. Now, I don't know, reward ultimately, but you see that. Reminds me of a mediation idea. These two to see me, and they didn't see their father's will, but they concluded that he was going to have his will organized in such a way that they were going to come with each other. They concluded that
he intended for them to be
assumed that he didn't know that, but they knew him. There was land that each of them was complicated, but certainly concluded that he was going to do, was going to essentially put them at odds with each other. And they decided, to their credit, to mediate what the will will be, even regardless of what he was writing. That's his will. He has a right to do it. They were going to have a separate document that they would use to override it and not tell him this.
So he could say what he wanted in his will. They were going to abide by a different agreement.
That's correct. And that was rather unique. I've seen things. Yeah, that was amazing that they had the ability and the forethought, and they could see that that was going to happen.
I mean, did it actually happen? Has he passed away?
I just did that. I didn't find that what happened. You know, I never found out. It was going to happen many years later. We did all the work, and they were happy, and they had an agreement, and they signed it, and then they knew that whatever he did didn't matter. They had taken care of all of this. So that's an estate dispute before it even happened. They realized that. You know, and I've seen nasty estate disputes, and as we all have, and lawyers, you know, don't, you know, eventually goes to court, and you know, surrogate, you know, these things can get very messy. So that's another area where I think media is the work. And that's very interesting to me, particularly, is the area of grandparent access, which is very complicated. And a couple of examples, but I'm talking about a situation not where a grandparent, the child dies, the parent, a parent dies, and then what happens? The cases are kind of somewhat in most jurisdictions. I'm talking about cases where grandparents being aided for alien children because they won't let the grandparents see the children because of their spouse, someone's wife that doesn't like their mother. I mean, those kind of things, I think we need more movement in that area. That's an area that hasn't been particularly promoted, though I'm working with a colleague on how to promote that more. It's very complex because, for example, in New York State, grandparents typically have rights. The idea being, if I don't want my parents to see my children, I have that right.
Mm-hmm.
And like, wow, that makes sense. On one level, and you can make a case for something else, but by statute, by case law, there isn't a lot of protection for grandparents. The exceptions in the cases that come out where you see it differently is if, as a grandparent, I raised a child and the mother was in prison and then she comes out and says you can't see the kid anymore, that's not going to happen. But you know, there's also mediating open adoption is mm-hmm. another area for us to work on. I had an interesting case where there was a child had a foster mother. The mother actually had been in prison. She was out now, rehabilitated. She had visitation. The foster mother was trying to adopt the child and terminate the parents, the birth mother's rights as a parent. Very complex case. And we really went very far with that case in mediation. So though ultimately didn't complete it. You know, that was a number of years ago. I would be in that kind of case.
But there's a lot of areas that have developed or are in development and lots of resources then for families who have a variety of whatever the issue might be. There is no professional education that they can go to. Actually, what I'm getting to is we have just a couple minutes left in the show. If a person is looking for media, what should they look for?
For in terms of the qualities of media?
Quality of media, you know, how do I decide, okay, I'm going to choose you?
You know, I think that, you know, as in many other relationships, I think that you either feel comfortable with someone or you don't. Mm-hmm. I would go by comfort level. I think it's more similar to, in that sense, well, I think if you're working with a therapist, you'd certainly want someone you're comfortable with. You know, perhaps somewhat less so with an attorney, but I think you need to have that with an attorney also. But I think the way people look at their attorneys are they can be more of an authoritarian figure, and it's okay if I don't like them because maybe that'll be good for me somehow. You know, but of course, people switch attorneys a lot, and that probably isn't good. I think that the gut feeling, you know, you don't have to really be that comfortable with your dentist, I guess, but because you're not talking that much. But even there, I think there's a kind of chemistry, if you will. I think that you really, I think you really either feel comfortable with someone or you don't. And you know, you could ask always, why don't I feel comfortable? But I think by and large, there is that feeling, and you should go with someone who you feel comfortable with, regardless of anything else.
Right.
That would be my sense of it.
Well, that's wonderful advice and something that's easy to follow for folks. And Ken, I thank you so very much for coming back and sharing some time with me airing this show. I really enjoyed finding out from you what you wanted, that you actually became what you wanted to be.
I guess I really learned that. Thank you. I had made that connection.
Fantastic. Everyone who's listening, thanks for joining us. The show is available download in minutes. And those of you who are going to be listening on the recording is going to continue. For those of you who are listening live, the show is going to end in about 20 seconds. So we're grateful for you coming, and we want you to join us again next time. We're going to finish with another piece from Michelle Webb. It's called Zeynel, and it's also from her CD, DC Istanbul. her work is available on iTunes, and I encourage you to buy the music and support our independent artists. Have a fabulous week, and we will see you again or talk to you again soon.